Good morning. So we'll start off today by talking a bit about arrays, leading up to some stuff which is mostly covered here because you might come up on the next lab, or the current lab, rather. So I think you probably kind of saw this before when we talked about vectors. So when you have an array, when you're allocating it as a local variable, it looks like this. You saw that you did something with the pointer when you were allocating it with dynamically. So you could, say, return a pointer to it. And then to access things in the array and the vector, use the same notation if you didn't care about bounds checking. And if you cared about bounds checking, well, you better do it yourself for the array. There's not a shortcut. So there's some other things which perhaps we got into less detail about how arrays work. And one notable thing is how copying works. So if I have two arrays, if I write A equals B and try to compile that, I'll get an error. It says, nope, can't do that. Sorry. If I have two vectors and I write A equals B, it will work. It will do what I think you expect, which is copy element by element from B to A, including resizing A if necessary. But with an array, you're going to have to do a normal, primitive array, you're going to have to do that work yourself. Another thing is equality, and this is more subtle. So if I do A equals equals B, that compiles. And it does something. It checks whether these are actually the exact same array. It compares the pointer, the addresses of the arrays, which probably wasn't what you would have wanted if you wrote that in your code. You probably wanted something which like goes through the array and actually compares element by element. If you do this on a vector, the vector has an override for the equals operator, which does what you probably expect and actually compares every element and the sizes. And we learned that arrays work as just being continuous memory. So if we have an array here, some ints, it's going to be stored at some memory address. I've just chosen hex 10,000 here. 0x is what I'm writing to mean hexadecimal, because that's what it is in C++, rather. And we have a pointer, which is located at some address, which we set equal to the array, and that points to the first element. It has the address of the first element. And this is our array in memory. So notice that I have an array of ints. If you remember on our lab machines, ints are 4 bytes, and that's why there is 4 bytes between the addresses of each of these ints. And that's always going to be true for primitive arrays in C++, that you take the size of each element, that's the distance difference between the addresses of consecutive elements, always. Can't do any tricks where we add extra space or anything like that. And so this means you can see this by, say, printing things out. So if you print out things, you might get output something like this. If you try to use some ints just natively, it'll print out the address. So arrays will act a lot like a pointer to them. And the general rule is that if you use an array where a pointer is expected, it will convert it to a pointer, to the first element. They aren't the same thing. I'll mention one of the notable differences later. And here we see this is get the address of the first element of the array, and that's the same as the address the array turns to when we try to use it in a place where, well, we have to output something, and cout does not have an output operator for arrays. It has an output operator for pointers, and we can convert the array to a pointer, so that's the one that's used. If they defined one for arrays, which they could have done, it would require a template because for various reasons, but they could have done that. in which case it would have output something else. And here we get the address of the second element, and that's 4 plus that. And so you'll see this on your real systems. And we see that when we get the actual element, we get, of course, the value that's stored there. So any questions on this aspect of array memory layout? How things look in memory? Yes?
So if the array has like other types other than like int, is it going to have a different byte between?
Yes. So if we had declared an array of longs, the difference would be 8. And if you had declared an array of something like a rational, the difference would be whatever the size of each rational was. Okay. So one thing about arrays that is a bit tricky to understand is this weird special case. So what I have up here, this is a valid function declaration. And it is exactly the same as this, which seems a bit weird because, you know, I'm telling you that arrays convert to pointers and they aren't the same thing. And this is true. In fact, there are ways we can observe that arrays aren't the same thing as pointers. But in this case, they're exactly equivalent. There's a special case that if you have an array, something which looks like an array as a function parameter, it actually means a pointer. That you can't actually put an array there. And this means in particular that if I ask for the size of pointer to array, I get the size of a pointer. Even though if I ask for the size of some int, say in main here, I'm going to get the size of the array, the amount of storage those three array elements take up. Yes.
So does the array get converted to a pointer when it's called in the function?
The question is, does the array get converted to a pointer? Yes. When we do the function call, it does.
But otherwise, it's not really the same.
So the array will get converted to a pointer anytime you try to use it. Otherwise, so for most purposes, it ends up being the same. But we have this notable exception of getting the size of is one of the cases where that doesn't happen. Another case where it wouldn't happen is if you got a pointer to the array, it would not be a pointer to pointer, it would be a pointer to an array, which is a different type. We probably will never use that type because it's not actually very useful, but it's a different type. Yes?
So could you put in the bottom part, could you put an array in a pointer to an array parameter there, even though it's not asking for an array?
In the bottom part, that's what we're doing, basically. Here, if that's what you mean. Put an array, even though it's not a pointer to an array, or it's not a. Yeah. So that's what we're doing here. We're passing an array, and even in the top part, I could have had some int star p comes from something and passed p to some func, where p was that pointer, an int star pointer. Even though it looks like it requires an array. Yes?
So when we declare an array, it is a pointer, but when we access the values in the array, it should connect to the array's name. Does it automatically dereference?
The question is, when we declare, so there's two parts there. So first asked, when we declare an array, it is a pointer. So this is not quite true. And the notable way was that I mentioned here the size of difference. If you ask for the size of an array, it's not the same as the size of a pointer. Another noticeable difference is that you notice that I didn't mark any of these as summons, just not summons of something. We don't actually store the address 0x1000 when you just write the first line here. The compiler just knows some ints is these three things and figures that out as you need it. Like, it's not the case that we have some place which is storing the address of the array. We just know there's a local variable, this is the local variable, it takes up 12 bytes. Just like when we have a long, we don't have some place which stores the address of the long and also the long's value. But when you try to, you know, use the array in a way where you want a pointer to it, the compiler will just create one all the time. So for the most part, you can pretend that arrays are pointers and get away with it. But the big exception is when is size of. And there's a few other very subtle cases which come up very rarely where it's different. Yeah, but for the most part, you can pretend it's a pointer that you just can't change where it points to. That's a constant pointer. Yes?
So in the second example, if you were to pass an integer into its own function and then another integer, like, would that still work because it's integer small?
So the question is, if I were to pass, so what do you mean by pass an integer? So you're saying I'm writing some func of I and j, where I and j, I have int I comma j. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
No. So this would say you're passing I. This is an int, but I expected an int star, and it would say the same thing regardless of which declaration we used.
What if you pointed a pointer to an int?
So what if I made a pointer to that? So if I did that, then this would be an int star, and this would be that would be fine. It would compile. It would run. Now, if we try to use I, the pointer to I as an array, and try to access anything but the first element, what we're going to do is we're going to say we have our pointer to I. So let's say this is actually I. And we try to access the second element. We're going to access whatever's in memory after I. And that's probably not a good idea. But the code will compile and it will try to do that. It probably not work out too well if we ever access the second element of that so-called array. Okay, so so for the most part, you can pretend there are pointers, but there's some cases where differences will come up, which I'm mentioning because when they do, it's very hard to understand what's going on. And the most notable thing to keep in mind is that size of behaves differently. So if you're relying on size of to know about how big is this array or how big is this pointer, just keep in mind that it matters whether it's really an array or not. So let's talk about multi-dimensional arrays, which I will call arrays of arrays. So these are really arrays of arrays, is how I would think of them. There's not really special support for multi-dimensional arrays like you might see in some other languages. I guess not Java, but there's other languages sometimes have like special support for this. Here, it's really, when we, our first thing here is an array of three arrays of two things. So we can access the individual rows of this array. So we have an array of two arrays of three things. And we can access the individual rows, probably what you're used to in Java, where we have the first element, second, third, of the first row and the first, second, third of the second row. Yes?
I think we have a typo in the second row.
So oh, yes. Row. Yeah, obviously. Yes, I. That was a great copying and paste work. So. Okay. So you would think, based on what we've said before, that what was happening here is that we had some, is that the way this would work is that we'd have n0 was a pointer to something and n1 was a pointer to something. you think that how it works, but this is a case where the difference between arrays and pointers comes up. So the actual storage looks like this. They're actually contiguous. There's no pointers. It's just we have all the elements one after another. Row at a time. So this is often called row major order. So we store the rows together. We could also do column major order, or we store the columns together. And so you can think of it as this sort of layout. And I'm saying that this is an array of arrays because what you can see is happening here is that we have two three-element arrays stored consecutively, which is the same thing we have for normal arrays. In normal, an array of ints, we had an array of three ints. They were all stored one after another. Here we have an array of arrays. The two arrays are stored one after another in memory. Each of them, in this case, takes up 12 bytes. So they're 12 bytes apart from each other. And so, if I correct three, sorry for typo here. So, a note on what's happening internally. So I mentioned that pointers to arrays are different than pointers to pointers. So what we really have here is when we ask for p of one, we're getting the address for an array at one. So when we're asking for n of zero, we're going to get this array. So when we ask for the address of that, we're going to get this address. When we ask for n of 1, we're getting this array. So we're going to get that address. And to make this work, there's actually a type pointer to array, which is how we can ask for, have an n, where we can say n of 0, n of 1, advances by 12, not by 4, not by 8. Like a pointer would, because pointers are size 8, we want to actually advance. When we ask for n of 1 versus n of 0, we want to advance by 12. That's how C++ keeps track of that. We'll never ask you about pointers to array types because the syntax is really, really confusing. Like, that is real syntax. That doesn't make much sense. We will not ask you about it. But that's what's happening internally. That's why it does something different than what you expect for, say, an int pointer. Because it's not an int pointer. It's a pointer to an array. It knows that each entry in this, each row is 12 bytes. And that's how it knows how to go n0 and n1 are 12 bytes apart. So next I'd like to talk about a use of arrays, which is why the bigger reason why we're mentioning it, that we really can't avoid in C++. So ideally, we just use vectors all the time, because they're generally more convenient than arrays. But here, we really have an array that we can't avoid. So this is a way you can declare main. So far, I think we've been declaring main with void, or we've had these arguments and haven't used them. But we'd like to get command line parameters. When you run your program with some arguments, you'd like to use those arguments. If you're implementing ls, it sure would be nice to get the name of the file that someone is writing, or the -l option. And this is how that's passed to C++ programs. So that we have an integer traditionally called argc, which is the number of arguments plus one. and we have argv, which is an array of pointers. It's not an array of arrays, it's an array of pointers to C style strings. I'll remind you or tell you, I don't know if we've gone over it, what C style strings are in a second. And the first element of this array points to the program name. So if our program is called ls, if that's what that was typed on the command line, it will be ls. If someone typed .a.out, it will be .a.out. It's whatever was typed on the command line to run the program. And the remaining parameters, remaining elements, are the actual arguments as strings. So if you have a bunch of space-separated arguments, each of them will be in a separate element. And this will also take into account, like, if you quote something, that becomes one argument. That's something that your shell does, not the program that actually is gets called. Yes?
So if we access the elements of the array using those arguments, are we accessing the char value, or?
The question is, when we access the elements of the array using, like, argv of 0,
yeah,
what are we accessing? So, sure. Let's talk about that. So here, this is what a hypothetical layout of argv might look like. So here, argv is the address 10,000 hex. So at 10,000 hex, we have a couple pointers. Our first pointer is to address 20,000 hex, and our second pointer is to address 20,003A hex. And at 20,000 hex, we have dot slash A dot O, U, T, and a zero character. That's the value zero, which is how a C-style string is terminated. So a C-style string is an array where we know what the last element is by this backslash zero, which is just the value zero stored in a byte. And we have our second thing, pointer, which is arg1 and a backslash zero, so that's the string arg1. So this is what a typical layout might look like. So if you ask for argv of zero, you'll get this pointer. If you have something which expects a C-style string, that's what you pass. It knows that that's a pointer to the beginning of a string, an array of characters, and I know where the end of the array is by this backslash zero. If you want to access the individual characters, you can use this syntax, which is the same as creating a temporary pointer with argv of zero and then doing that pointer of zero, pointer of one, and so on. So any questions about this layout, what happens? Yes? So the question is, what is star argv0? And this is the same thing here. So if you do star argv0, use the same thing as argv0 of 0. Because if we had a pointer to a character with an address, if you do star, you just get the thing at that address, the character at that address. And another notable thing that I want to emphasize is that by the rule I showed you earlier, these two declarations are the same. They're exactly the same because the array in a function declaration, the array syntax is just shorthand for pointer. And you can write whatever one you feel most comfortable with. Okay, so we've seen that these are C-style strings, so you could like manually iterate through these and like look for the backslash zero, the zero character at the end, to figure out how to print them out and like copy them into strings. But we have some nice shortcuts for this. So first of all, if you have a char star that you say assigned to argv of one, you can output it by just using it in cout. This is how character pointers get output by cout, is that they assume it's a C-style string. They don't output the address. They just say, it's a char pointer. I'm going to assume you mean a C-style string. You can also convert it to a C++ style string by using a constructor that takes a char star, or using an assignment operator that takes a char star. In both cases, it's going to assume you mean a C-style string.
It's an integer input, can we use A to I, like so?
If it's an integer input, can you use A to I? Yes. So this is also the same sort of thing, which if you did in the lab, that s.c_string returns a char pointer of this kind. And so they act in basically the same way.
What is that return? Sorry.
This C star string, this returns, so we have some string, this returns a char pointer which has a backslash zero at the end. And it points to an array which has a backslash zero at the end. So any other questions about this? So this means here that we have an example program for outputting our command line parameters. So here I get argc and argv. I assume I have my program name in argv0. So I just print that out. And if we run this, it will print out the name that I wrote on the command line to run the program, because I wrote argv0 there. And here, I'm demonstrating converting the strings. Like, I could have printed it out directly, but this would be what I want to do if I were doing more processing of the string in some way. I wanted to like look at certain characters and call substring, pass copies of the string or parts of the string to other functions. This is probably what you start by doing, is making a local variable that has a copy of the argument. And you can see that we're using argc here. This is why argc is 1 plus the number of arguments, because we have that zeroth element which contains the program name. So it lets you iterate through the arguments like this. Yes?
Doesn't argv0 point to just the address?
So argv0 has the address of the program of an array containing the program name, and that's what cout expects. When you output a character, when you output a pointer to a character with cout, it says this is a C style string. It doesn't output the address, it outputs the string it points to. And if it doesn't point to a string that has a backslash zero, the character with integer value zero at the end, you're in trouble. It's gonna like look at memory until it finds one and print that whatever is there out. So any questions on this? So let's do. Let's talk about Big O. So I think most of you have seen Big O in some form in a prior class. Is this true? Yes? Yeah. Okay. So we're going to probably be a little more formal about Big O in this class, and we need to talk about it because we're going to talk about data structures. And the reason you'd ever use a data structure that's not just an array or a linked list is because of better performance, and this is how we're going to know it has better performance. Like, we could measure it, but that's not actually what we want to do. And so Big O is about asymptotic growth rates, or what we'll sometimes call order. And it's about comparing two functions. Our functions typically are going to be things like, how long does it take for a given size? So given some size, what's the runtime? And we want to ignore some factors that we think in the long run aren't important. We don't want to not care about what happens for small inputs. I don't care if I'm not especially fast on 20 elements, because, well, anything on 20 elements is probably good enough. Like, if I do the stupidest possible thing for 20 elements, my program's probably still tolerably fast. What we really care about is when I have 1,000, what's happening. We also want to ignore constant factors. This is going to be useful because it will let us not worry about the details of how something is implemented. Like, we don't want to care, like, is a comparison faster than an addition? Like, that's not something we want to be worrying about. We just want to say, are we doing a lot more stuff or not? And this will let us have results which are like pretty agnostic to like what kind of machine we have, because we aren't caring about, you know, the differences which are like something is twice as fast. We're caring about bigger differences than that. So for example, I have two functions here. So I have a million times n squared and 2 to the n. And g grows faster. So eventually, with a big enough n, g is going to be much, much bigger than f. But of course, for small values, that's not true. And so our goal is going to be that we want to predict that this is going to happen, that when we get to, say, 30, we're in trouble if we think that g is our runtime, even though down here, things look great. G is way, way better. And so that's going to be our goal, that we're not going to care about the behavior which happens here. We're going to care about what happens when we get big enough. And this is going to be useful, practically speaking, for many problems, because we're going to worry about sufficiently large sizes of data. It's going to be a case where we care about performance, and the other ones don't. But you might have real situations where this big O doesn't tell you what you need to know. Like, if these are your two functions and the maximum n you can imagine is 15, well, big O doesn't tell you what you want to know. So I'm going to assert that that's not a common situation, but it does happen. But we're going to be just worrying about the behavior in this green region over here. We want to predict that that's going to happen, and we're going to be doing this mathematically. So what functions are we comparing? So there's two main quantities in this class that we're going to compare about asymptotic comparisons for. So one example is, let's say we're comparing sorting algorithms. There are two big things we might care about. So one is the runtime. And so as a concrete example, maybe we say that we have a function which tells us the number of seconds it's going to take us to sort something given the number of elements in a list. Or maybe we'll have something which, instead of measuring in seconds, we'll measure in the number of operations it will take us to sort something given the number of elements in the list. Because we're ignoring constant factors, we don't really care about the units. We're just not going to care about the units. We're just going to say, you know, some amount of time, we don't care what it is, because, you know, we don't care whether you're measuring in seconds or hours. That's going to disappear when we do the asymptotic comparison. So we're just going to measure some analog of runtime, and when I'm measuring operations, I'm making an implicit assumption that each operation takes a bounded or constant amount of time, which might not really be true, but is usually something we'll assume for the purpose of doing this analysis. We also might care about space. So I might say, how many bytes of memory is my sort algorithm going to allocate in addition to the size of my input if I have such a big list? You know, so we might care about that because some sort algorithms don't allocate anything. They just work on the list in place and with maybe like a couple temporary variables. And some sort algorithms like a copy of the whole thing. And this will let us sort of quantify that, and also any space that might be in between. Maybe there's a sort algorithm which copies not just one or two things, but and not the whole list, but something in between. We can figure out how to compare those. And when we talk about big O, we're going to talk about theoretical measurements. So you can make guesses about big O behavior from empirical measurements. Like, you can make a graph, you can plot the points on a graph by comparing two things, and you'll get an idea about what the big O behavior is. You'll see that curve, and you'll have an idea it's going higher or lower. But that doesn't mean you know what's really happening. If you have a graph, you don't know what happens further to the right. Maybe things stay the same, maybe they don't. If you don't actually have a sort of formula or model for what's happening, you can't tell that. So graphs are a good way to get an intuition, and they'll usually tell you the right answer. But you never really know if you just have empirical measurements that something doesn't change when you get to a much bigger size. And it might be a bigger size than you can practically test. It might be a size where the thing you're testing takes hours. And if you actually cared about running on that size in the real world, you definitely care about whether it takes hours or days, but you sure aren't going to measure it as you're doing things. So we're going to write down a formula. So for example, if I'm summing a list of n items, I know that that takes exactly n addition operations, and I'll assume something like that each one takes k units of time. You might have disputes about that assumption, and they're good ones, like how big is my sum going to be? But we'll usually assume that each of these operations takes a constant amount of time, and therefore my runtime is k times n. And this is the sort of formulas we'll be dealing with. And our motivation for this, if you recall, started out, is that when we have big sizes, we get these very disparate performance. And we saw that we had these sum runtimes, which get very big as data sizes get large. And we had sum runtimes, which remain manageable as data sizes get large. And you have these huge differences. And yes, you can try to measure these. But we'd really just like to know that these have a bad growth rate, these other ones don't, and know about that theoretical behavior. So this thing we're going to get across with that is, can my program work when the data gets big? How is this going to behave? So like if you have a website, you know, and you have thousands of users, does your stuff actually still work even though you were only testing with like five? And a way that might not happen is if you're doing something like iterate through all users every time you like you load a page for a user. Like that might not work very well. If I have a text editor, is it going to work when I open a 1 megabyte book? Is it going to work when I open a 1 gigabyte log file? You'd like to know whether that's going to happen. If I have a music player, is it going to work when, you know, instead of having like a couple albums, I load 1,000 or 50,000 song collection? Or is it going to do something where it just is sluggish and I can't actually scroll anywhere and it's unusable? If I'm doing text search, yeah, I've tested it locally, but can I do it on my copy of all pages on the web, which is like 100 petabytes if I'm Google? So we'd like to know whether all these things would work. And if our growth rate analysis says no, we can find this out before we implement the algorithm. This is the key idea. Like, we could get those measurements I showed you earlier, showing what happens. And most of the time, we can find out before we get to sizes that are impractical to measure, whether it's a problem. But asymptotic analysis, because we're working with formulas, we'll find out before we implement anything, before we go through the work of handling all the annoying corner cases, like, you know, where we implement a linked list and handle the head and tail and all those stuff, you can find out, oh, this is not going to work for this problem. It's going to be too slow. And we're going to find out this in cases where doing something like buying a faster CPU is not going to fix our problem. If we look at the sort of runtimes I'm dealing with here, if I have something that takes 263 seconds instead of less than one, then if I buy a CPU that is 10 times faster, that's not really solving my problem. Right? I'm not going to solve this problem by throwing resources at it. And this is going to generally be true in cases where we do asymptotic analysis and says, ooh, this is a bad idea. OK. So any questions about our motivation for asymptotic analysis? OK, so we're going to deal with sets of functions. And we're going to have some reference function f. So you might have seen some common f's would include things like n, f of n equals n, which is what's known as linear time. or f of n equals n squared, which is what's known as quadratic time. So these are common, just usually simple functions that we're going to compare to. Doesn't have to be, but that's usually what we'll deal with. And we have these three sets. So we have big omega of f, and these are functions which grow no slower than f. They're at least as slow as they're at least as big as f, and possibly a lot bigger. We have big O of f. This is functions which grow no faster than f. They're no bigger than f, and possibly smaller. And we have big theta of f, which is functions that grow as fast as f. So in an asymptotic sense, they're as big as f. Note that this is probably not the intuition you had about big O from prior courses. So usually, we talk about functions being big O of f informally, and often what we really mean is that they're big theta of f, that they're the same. But big O of f is really just an upper bound. It's just how bad could it be? But it might not be precise. It might not be the most precise bound you can have. So you might say something is, you know, big O of n squared, when really it's like n log n, which is better than n squared. But you can still say it's big O of n squared, and maybe in cases where you have a complicated algorithm, you can't easily prove the lower bound, the better bound, and you can only have an upper bound which is not tight. But usually in prior courses, when they've said something is big O of f, they really meant it's big theta of f. That they mean that not only is it not worse than, say, n squared or n, but it's also as good as that. So some examples. N to the third is big omega of n squared. So cubic grows faster than quadratic. 100n is big O of n squared. It's smaller than n squared. It's actually a lot smaller. It's, you know, not just asymptotically smaller. And 10n squared plus n is big theta of n squared. So this is a case where, so 10n squared plus n grows as fast as n squared asymptotically. If you look at the graphs, there's a constant factor that's different between them, like they're always apart by like a factor of 10, but they grow at the same rate otherwise. So other than the constant factor, in the long run, they look the same. And this means that 10n squared plus n is big O of n squared and big omega of n squared. Both of those are true. So any questions about these examples? Okay. So we're measuring generally by default, unless we specify otherwise. We might sometimes measure other things, but usually we're measuring the worst case running time. And based on n, where n is our input size as a positive integer, it could have varying units. It could be like the number of elements in the array. It could be the number of bytes. It doesn't really matter because we don't care about constant factors. And you can like turn number of elements in the array into number of bytes by multiplying by something and so on. And we'll compare f to that. And I will use this notation here. So f of n is in big O of g of n, because big O and big omega and big theta is a set of functions. That's why I'm using that in. Informally, you might say f is big O of g. This is what I'm going to write formally, that it's in big O of g. And sometimes I will omit the n and just say f is in big O of, f is in big O of g without. But I'm saying in because big O of g is a set of all the functions which are asymptotically no bigger than g. And I might say is not in. So I might say, therefore, f is not big omega of g, similarly. And again, big omega is a set. We're talking about membership in a set. So sometimes you'll see equality written informally. I'm going to try to avoid that. I'm not going to say F equals big O because big O is a set, F is a singlet member of that set. So I'm not going to write equality unless I'm comparing two sets of functions in that way. So note that we're talking about worst case. So why do we care about worst case? Well, we want to detect if the program will ever run forever. No. So one example is, let's say I'm iterating through an array until I find a value. Our best case is the values at the beginning of the array. So potentially, this algorithm could find the value in constant time. If it's always at the beginning, it finds the value immediately. What we care about is what happens in the worst case. So when we're writing the F for this algorithm, we're going to assume the worst possible thing happens, and the worst possible thing is we look in the array and it's not there. And that means we have to look at every single element. So our F of N is not going to be like, what's the average number of elements we look at? It's going to be, what's the worst possible thing that could happen for each input size? So you can think of it as, we take all the possible inputs of size N, and we write down the time for the slowest one. So let's start with formal definitions, and I assume we'll have to go through this in a lot next time, which is fine. So when we say F of N is in big O of G of N, what we're going to mean formally is that we can find a C and an N sub 0, which are both greater than 0, such that for all N bigger than that N sub 0, so once N gets big enough, F of N is less than the constant C times G of N. So this is the ignoring constant factors, is that we can choose a constant factor that's big enough, and then F of N is no bigger than G of N. And we're also saying that we only care about N when N is big enough. So if you want to prove something is big O in big O of something else, you're going to have to find an N0 and a C, and then prove that this always holds if those are true. And if you want to prove it isn't, you have to show that no matter what C and N0 I choose, I can find some N bigger than that where it's not true. If I make N big enough versus the N0 you gave me, you know, I can find a counterexample to this inequality. So big omega, we just reverse the inequality. And big theta is just, we test both definitions, and if they're both true, it's in big theta. So any questions on these definitions? So in our last minute, let's go through a simple example of how we would show this. For what? So we have our definition, and I want to show that N is in big O of N squared. So what I can do, I can choose C equals 1 and N0 equals 2. So I'm saying for N greater than 2, that N is less than or equal to C of N squared, which is N squared, and this is going to be true because once we're bigger than 2, 2 squared is bigger than, you know, bigger than 2, and 3 squared is bigger than 3. You can show that in general. And so that's sufficient to show it, prove it. So you can prove this in that way. You can work out the inequality and show that it's always true for N bigger than 2. And 2 might not be the smallest number I could have chosen, But that's something you should feel free to take advantage of. Like, I could probably have chosen n0 equals 1, but I didn't need to. And so we'll talk more about more examples of using the formal definitions next time. Good luck on the lab.